He says it is quite legitimate for a poet to render his vision, to describe his experience. It is his right. And if it turns out to have philosophical overtones, he can't help it. And he says, not only Savitri, but many of his poems, like Nirvana and other sonnets, they have been criticized because they have the philosophical overtones. He says they are not philosophical. They are spiritual experiences rendered in poetry, very natural. And in the course of the letter, he says, to me, inconscient, ignorance, are not concepts, but they represent to me concrete realities with which I am face to face time and again. I have felt the colossal resistance of inconscience, the opposition of ignorance, and I have a right to render it in my poetry. Then he narrates how. If he were to write how a stream of anger rushed at him, if he were to write that, the critic would ask, how can anger rush in a stream? He said, but that was my concrete experience when I was sitting in the veranda of the guest house. I did feel a current of anger mounting towards me. And it was verified later when the person concerned confessed it. So, what we think to be imaginations, poetical figures, they are matters of actual experience for him. Now, tease the inconscient to wake ignorance. This stir teased the inconscient, prodded it. And from the inconscient, when it moves, when it wakes up, what comes forth is ignorance, not knowledge, partial consciousness. That is ignorance. And this throb leaves a quivering trace, a vibrating trace, giving room to some old want which was unfilled, not fulfilled. That comes up. An old, tired want which was so long lying in peace in the moonless cave of the subconscious. It gave room to that want to raise its head. And look for absent light. It has some old memory. It remembers it was not her wish was not fulfilled. So it looks, straining its closed eyes. The eyes are not seeing, and it strains to see where is that light. The light is absent. And there is another simile which most of us will recognize as something answering to our experience in life at some stage or other. That is, that want looks for absent light, but is disappointed, like one who searches for a bygone self and only meets the corpse of his desire. That is, at some stage in life, we remember how years ago, how time and time ago, we had this desire. And then we say, let us fulfill that desire. At that time we could not fulfill it. Now we are in a position to do that. And we try. But then, when the opportunity is there, we feel that we get only the corpse of his desire. The object does not give that satisfaction. And when we are face to face with that object, that intensity of desire is not there. That moment has passed. But the subconscious memory makes us want to go back to that experience. But it is never the same. And this old tired want, it looks as if in the whole core of dissolution of the past, there lurks some unremembering entity. It doesn't remember, but there is an entity which has survived of a slain and buried past. And that entity which has survived the past pralaya is condemned to resume the effort and the pang. All this happens. And a consciousness without form, because at that time there is no form, looks for light. And a blank, there is a feeling that something is going to change. There is a yearning towards a distant change. This yearning, this desire for light, this movement to resume the effort and the pang, all of these act as if a childlike finger is laid on the cheek. That is, the night, she is the mother, from her womb the manifestation is to come. And this desire of that entity, this pull, is like a childlike finger laid on a cheek. Reminds her, oh, there is this need in things. And she wakes up. Here, there was a confusion, because he says, an infant longing clutched the somber vast. So the vast is not the mother of the universe. He says the vast is only a veil covering the face of the night, which is the mother. And these longings, these yearnings, act like a child's finger touching the cheek, reminds her, oh, this is the need to be filled, this is the work to be done. And at that time, a breach began, an opening in the darkness slowly begins. A long line of hesitating hue, the light, the color that is slowly coming is hesitating. It is not sure of itself that it will prevail. And the imagery he gives is something remarkable. That is, a vague smile tempting a desert heart. That is, the heart, for whatever reason, frustration, disappointment, defeat, whatever it is, frustrate, it has become like a desert. And in that desert, there is no emotion. There is no response. So, a vague smile, somebody is trying to tempt that desert heart to respond. But that smile, which hopes to enliven that heart, is not very pointed, not sure of itself either, that it will succeed. So it is a vague smile. And this vague smile, that is a quivering hue, troubled the far rim of life's obscure sleep. The distant rim of sleep, the state of sleep, is disturbed by the long hesitating hue. And that vague smile, that hesitating view, is really an eye of deity . The eye of the goddess of dawn pierces through the dumb deeps. Dumb means they are not responding. Deeps in the profounds. In that dark extension, this hesitating light acts like an eye of deity. And this eye of deity has come like a scout, an advance volunteer in a reconnaissance from the sun. You know, when the army advances, before it moves further, it sends forward a few advance men to find out the positions of the enemy, how far, what is safe, how far this army can advance. Now these are the scouts of reconnaissance. Now reconnaissance is a typical expression of modern warfare, which Sri Aurobindo uses in his epic. You know, and that reflects the contemporary idiom, which is a necessity of a successful Mahakavya. And that scout from the sun has stepped in the torpor of a sick and weary world. The past weariness, the past inertness is still there. And in that heavy cosmic rest, it slowly comes to seek for a spirit desolate and soul, too fallen to recollect forgotten bliss. This is that entity, unremembering entity, the fallen boundless self, which is slowly remembering. Now this scout from the sun has come seeking for that, searching for that spirit. Where is that? Where is that? And in its movement, the message of the scout of light crept through the reluctant hush, the hush of darkness, the hush of inertness, is unwilling to be disturbed, does not want to be awakened. That is why he says it's the reluctant hush. And the message that this point of light, hesitating you, is calling the adventure of consciousness and joy to leave this state of sleep, darkness, inertness, and waking up to the adventure of consciousness and joy. And this scout, this forerunner of dawn, conquering nature's disillusioned breast, because nature has been disillusioned. All its efforts in the past have met defeat, and there is no hope in its breast. Still, this forerunner, compelled renewed ascent to see and feel, nature agrees, consents to see and feel, and in that void a thought is sown. Till now it was a stir, it was a movement, it was a half remembrance, but now with the consent of nature there is the thought, there is a sense, there is a memory. All these, as if a soul long dead were moved to live. The soul is inspired to live. But what happens? The previous fall had obliterated all the crowded tablets of the past, crowded memories, lessons of experience. They had all been wiped out. You could not build on past experience. And that is why he says all that was destroyed must be rebuilt and old experience labored out once more. Each cycle of manifestation, you have to renew the whole labor. But, he says, in another memorable epigram, all can be done if the God touch is there. It may have been wiped out, things may have been in a hopeless condition, and the labor immense, but still, if the God touch is there, all can be done. Nothing depends upon our effort, human effort. All is not left to nature. If a touch of God is there, all that we think is impossible can be done. And that is where we'll stop today, remembering all can be done if the God touch is there. With the arrival of the scout of reconnaissance from the sun, there is a spring of hope where the remnant of the last spirit, broken, fallen, was in despair, a ray of hope comes up as a result of the eye of deity that pierces through the dumb deeps. But that hope is very, very tentative. It hardly dares to live. The surroundings, the atmosphere is so alien, indifferent, that the hope hardly dares to be. And at that time, there is a dim appeal of light from some distant corner of heaven, as if it has come in search of this broken spirit And that appeal itself feels like an orphan. And it is looking for this spirit. But it is very unsure of itself. However, as a result of this hope, which is very infant, and the dim appeal from the distant nook of heaven, there is a thrill which repeats itself, and each time it throbs, it has a transfiguring touch, and that thrill of the appeal persuades the inert black quietude. Sri Aurobindo, in a note, explains why he has used each of these words. Quietude, to hint that there is a spiritual element there. Even in that inertness, there is a spiritual element. And at the same time, to emphasize its concreteness, you see, he has used the word black, persuaded the inert black quietude, and the result is beauty and wonder disturb the fields of God. Till now, the fields of God, they were almost dead, inert, unresponsive. But now, there is beauty and wonder vibrating throughout the fields of God. In the meanwhile, there in the nook of heaven, there is a hand of God, there is a hand that opens and fixes the window pane so that revealing a lot of mysteries behind. It is as if it is windowing the hidden things. And once the window is opened, there is a rush of light. And that light forced the world's blind immensity to sight. That is, the darkness of the world is seen in the background. The light is the background. And you can see the darkness. Normally we would say you can see the light with the background of darkness. You say the darkness was so concrete that that was visible. And the darkness failed and slipped away like a falling cloak from the reclining body of a god. The suggestion is that behind the darkness there is God, there is the body of God. And this darkness is something like a dress and something like a veil. It slips off. And then through that little rift, which seemed hardly enough for a trickle from the suns, there outpours a revelation in the flame. Once it opens, the light rushes, and the brief perpetual sign recorded above, the brief perpetual sign refers to the dawn. Now the dawn is always brief. But why is it perpetual? Perpetual because it's constant. It comes again and again. One dawn doesn't make much difference. One dawn is followed by another dawn. Also, always at some point on earth, there is an outbreak of dawn. If it is night today here, there is another place where a dawn is breaking. That's why it is a perpetual feature of this earth. And recurrence again and again. Sri Aurobindo quotes at the beginning of his masterwork, Life Divine, a passage from the Veda on this theme of recurrence of the dawn. The dawn is followed by another dawn. There are a series of dawns. So the dawns do not stop at any time. In a chapter on human aspiration, he gives this as a motto, the dawn. And in his translation, the meaning is very clear. He says, she follows to the goal of those that are passing on beyond. That is, number of dawns have already gone. And she, today's dawn, follows the goal of those that are passing on beyond. That means there is a goal. It is not a mechanical journey, but there is an aim. She follows to the goal of those that are passing on beyond. She is the first in the eternal successions of dawns that are coming. If she is the last of the dawns that have gone, she is also the first of the succession of dawns that are ready, that are coming. Usha, that is the dawn, goddess of dawn, widens, bringing out that which lives, awakening someone who was dead. She does two operations. One that is alive as a result of the past so many dawns, she widens that scope. She extends them and she awakens someone who was dead. That is, almost disappeared in the inconscient, in the darkness. She awakens. What is her scope when she harmonizes with the dawns that shone out before and those that now must shine? The dawn of today has a mission, has a purpose. It has to relate. The burden of the dawns that are following with the work of the dawns that have gone. This coordination is the harmony which the dawn has to build. She desires the ancient mornings and fulfills their light. The mornings that have gone, they had a message. They carried the seeds of light. She fulfills them. Projecting forwards her illumination, she enters into communion with the rest that are to come. That is, not only she fulfills, she helps to ripen the seeds sown with the dawns that are gone ahead. But she also projects towards full manifestation what the rest have to bring. So there is a continuity of dawns, a feature of this creation. That is why he says, the brief perpetual sign record above. And there is a vision. There is a vision of dawn bringing her aura of magnificent hues. Dawn doesn't break into light immediately. Varied colors, hues come into play. And that is building her aura. And as it does that, it buries its seed of grandeur in the hours. What the dawn brings does not pass with the passing of the dawn. It acts like a seed and is buried in the time. Hours signify time. In the roll of time, she casts her seeds. Her grandeur is buried in the hours. An instant visitor, the Godhead shone. That is, there is a vision, there is an outbreak of dawn, there is a play, display of varied hues. And that vision, as it stands, it looks as if it is bending over the forehead curve. Earth is looking up. And that dawn, that vision, bends over it, giving a message, writing something as it were, telling the greatness of spiritual dawns. What she writes, which is not ordinarily decipherable, but still it is a hieroglyph of mystic sense. Hieroglyphs is that script which requires a special type of training to decipher. And it wrote lines of significant myth, telling of the greatness of spiritual dawns. Spiritual dawns. So far we have been speaking of physical dawns. But the physical dawn itself is a symbol of a spiritual dawn. And a spiritual dawn is an inner dawn. The onset or the outbreak of the light of consciousness. A higher consciousness in the inner life. Again and again, there is this manifestation of light. It fades after a while. Again it comes. So, a spiritual dawn repeats itself a number of times. And each dawn confirms the past gains and prepares the ground for future gains. And almost that day, the epiphany was disclosed. That is, we are at the beginning of a cycle of creation, and in the first outbreak of dawn, epiphany, the new birth, was disclosed. Not wholly, but something of a new birth of the cycle of this creation was disclosed. Now, once that vision, the light, it is a kind of impersonal manifestation. Once it has done its work, there comes the face, there comes the form. The divine manifests with form, without form, Murta and Amurta. So here first division, and thereafter there is a feeling of dread, as if something is walking, something is coming. And there was a face, a form of rapturous calm. It is only the divine consciousness, when it takes that form, it can have a calm, but a calm, not an inert calm, but a rapturous calm. At our level, when there is rapture, we can't hold calm. We are excited. We are vibrating. It is only in that level of divine consciousness that rapture and calm can be simultaneously held. And this face of the divine goddess of dawn, it has a rapturous calm. It is a center of infinity. Again a paradox. Infinity has no form. The moment you speak of form, there is finiteness. She is infinity's center. That is, if the infinity can be conceived as having a center, it is this phase which is having infinity center, that opens, parts her lids, eyelids, that open heaven. The eyelids are so beauteous, are so mystical, that when the eyes open, it is as if heaven has opened. You get an entry into heaven, and that face, when you hear the tread, this face appears, and a form from far beatitudes. Beatitude is different from bliss. Bliss, there is a constant vibration, there is an agitation, there is a movement. But beatitude is something tranquil, joy, a joyous it, I won't call it even a vibration, a state, yes. A state of happiness, oozing out benevolence. So from far beatitudes, this form seems to come near. And that is the ambassadress twixt eternity and change. There it is, eternity. And here, change means time. So the eternity is a different realm. Time is another. And in between is this goddess, is this divinity, is this center of infinity. She is the ambassadress connecting the two. The omniscient goddess, knowing all. She holds all knowledge in herself. She looks, she leans across the breadths. That form, the spaces for the journey of the stars. And when she looks, she sees the spaces are ready for her feet. To put her feet, they are all ready. And just before she goes, she half looked, not fully, but she half looked. That is that graceful term half term for her wayward son. Is he ready? That is, after the dawn comes the sun. So before coming ahead, before moving ahead, she looks partly at her back to look for her veiled son. The sun is still veiled. Then, thoughtful because the sun is not ready, the work to be done, she went to her immortal work. The ambassadress, Usha, she moves forward for her work which is immortal, which is undying. And at that event, when she steps out, nature hears her steps. The waking ear, the ear of nature is alert, and it hears her steps, and the wideness, the vastness of nature turns its limitless eye to her. And then, what is her response? Her luminous smile. She smiles. It is a luminous smile, full of light, spreading light everywhere. And she scatters her smile on sealed depths, because nothing is awake, everything is dark. On those sealed depths, she scatters her luminous smile, as a result of which the silence of the world is kindled to fire. All that silence suddenly turns into a flame. And as a result, all grows worshipful. All grows into a rite, a ritual. And in this worship, air is a vibrant link between earth and heaven. Heaven and earth. In between is the air. And the wind acts like a priest. For the worship, a priest is necessary. And the great priestly wind, the voice of the wind, is the hymn of worship. The wind makes a certain sound, and that is the wide-winged hymn. That hymn arose, and what rises, after a while it has to slow down, and failed upon the altar hills. The hills in nature, they are as if the Vedi, the platform on which the fire is lighted and the worship offered. And when the priest of the wind, that is the priest, emits a sound which is a hymn, it rises and falls back upon the hills which are the altar. And the high boughs, the high branches of the trees, pointing upwards, it looks as if they are praying. Each tree has boughs in a revealing sky. They are looking, praying. And in that sky is seen what is to come. It reveals, it shows. And that is the adoration of nature, of the goddess of dawn. We'll continue next time.